The logic was clear enough. They had been surprised by the convoy. They couldn't get to safety without more fuel. If they took us with them on their begging expedition, it'd be obvious that they were smugglers and they would get in trouble. So they had to park us for a while. They knew we'd object, so they had left us no choice. Braj had caught up with me. He had produced, from somewhere, a small weapon. But as he and I both understood, there was no point in taking potshots at the backside of the tractor. Only it and the two men in it could get us out of here. When Braj and I got back to the sledge, dragging the fuel and the energy bars, we found Laro and Dag kneeling, face to face, holding each other's hands and mumbling so rapidly that I couldn't make out a single word. I had never seen any behavior quite like it, and had to watch them for a few moments before I collected that they were praying. Then I felt embarrassed. I stepped back to get out of Braj's way in case he wanted to join them, but the look on his face as he regarded the Deolaters was contemptuous. He caught my eye and jerked his head back toward the flaps. I joined him outside. Both of us were hooded, goggled, and swathed against the cold. Frost grew with visible speed on our face masks as we talked. Braj had been checking his watch every few minutes since we had been abandoned.
"It's been a quarter of an hour," he said. "If those guys haven't come back for us in 2 hours, we have to save ourselves."
"You really think they'd leave us here to die?" Braj chose not to answer that question, but he did offer,
"They might get into a situation where they have no choice. Maybe they can't get fuel, maybe their tractor breaks down, or the military commandeers it. Point being, we have to have our own plan."
"I have a pair of snowshoes."
"I know. We have to make 3 more. Load up your water pouch."
The suit sacks had pouches on the front that could be stuffed with snow. Over time, it would melt and become drinking water. That consumed energy, but it was sustainable as long as the body had food or the suit sack had fuel. We had both, for the time being. We packed ours as full of snow as we could. We replenished our fuel bladders from the cache that the drivers had left for us. Braj interrupted the others' prayers and insisted they also take on water and fuel. Then he had us each eat a couple of energy bars. Only then did we get working. The tent was held up by flexible metal poles. We collapsed it and drew them out. This had the side effect of getting Laro and Dag's attention. Our shelter was gone. They had no choice but to join in our plan. Braj had a pocket tool with a little saw blade. He went to work cutting the tent poles into shorter segments. Once the others saw that there was work to be done, they joined in cheerfully. Dag, who was the sturdier of the two, took over the sawing of the tent poles. Braj had Laro get to work scavenging every inch of rope and twine at our disposal. Then, perhaps leading by example, he undid the yellow rope that he had used to gird his suitcase. This turned out to be some 30 feet long. He undid the latches and dumped out the contents, hundreds of tiny vials, all packed in loose nodules of foam. I hadn't seen such things before, but I guessed that these were pharmaceuticals.
"Child support,"
Braj explained, reading the look on my face. The panels of the suitcase were a tough leathery material that we cut into slabs to make the platforms of the snowshoes. We bent the tent poles to make crude quadrangular frames and lashed the suitcase panels to them using twine from Laro's and Dag's improvised baggage. This took a while because we had to do it with bare fingers, which went numb in a few seconds. The contents of Laro's and Dag's baggage were mostly old clothes, which they were willing to abandon, and keepsakes of their families, which they weren't. I pulled one of the benches off of the sledge, flipped it upside down, and kicked its flimsy legs off. It would serve as a toboggan. We loaded it with supplies and wrapped them up in what remained of the tent. My pack had already been stripped of its metal frame and of anything that would serve as rope. I added my energy bars and my stove to the supplies, threw away my extra clothes, and put my bolt, my cord, and my sphere, peeled down as small as it would go, into the cargo pockets on the body of my suit sack. I considered adding my cord to our stock of rope, but we seemed to have plenty. Laro had found a 50-foot coil stored under one of the sledge's benches, and we'd been able to make up another 50 by splicing together odds and ends from the tent's rigging and so on. That, plus Braj's 30 feet of yellow stuff, gave us enough that we were able to rope ourselves together at intervals of 30 or 40 feet, which Braj explained would be useful if one of us lost his footing on a steep slope or fell into a crevasse. These preparations consumed almost 4 hours, so we set out late according to Braj's timetable. The convoy down below seemed as though it had not moved an inch. Braj estimated that it was 2,000 feet below us. He said that if everything goes to hell, we should just pull the ripcord and let ourselves slide down the ice to the valley floor, where we could throw ourselves on the mercy of the military. They might arrest us, but they probably wouldn't let us die. It was a last resort, however, because if we tried it, we stood a good chance of falling into a crevasse before we reached the bottom. Braj took the lead. He was armed with a length of tent pole that he would use to probe the snow ahead of him for crevasses. At his hip, he had his sticker, a long, heavy-bladed knife. He claimed that if one of us fell into a crevasse, he would throw himself down and jam this into the ice, anchoring himself so as to arrest our fall. He had me go last and saw to it that I was armed with an L-shaped piece of metal scavenged from the frame of my pack, which I was to use in the same manner. He even had me practice throwing myself down face first and jamming the short leg of the thing into the ice. Dag, then Laro, were roped up between us. The toboggan trailed behind me. The first part of the trek was balky and frustrating as the snowshoes or the bindings that held them to the other's feet seemed to give out every few steps. The whole expedition seemed to have failed before it had started. But then I noticed we'd been going for a whole hour without pause. I sipped from the tube that ran down to my water pouch and munched slowly on an energy bar. I looked around me and actually enjoyed the view. All's well. The thought hit me like a snowball in the nose. I'd been out of the consent for a little more than 2 weeks, eating Extramuro's food the whole time. Leo and Arsabalt and the others had probably made it to Tredegar in less than a week, too brief a time for them to be affected. But I had been out long enough that the ubiquitous chemical must have taken up residence in my brain, subtly altering the way I thought about everything. What would my Fras and Sewers have said about the decisions I had been making recently? Nothing too polite. Just look at where those decisions had gotten me. And yet, even in the midst of this terrible situation, I'd been strolling around with nothing on my mind except for how pretty the view was. I tried to force myself into a sterner frame of mind, tried to envision some bad outcomes so that I could lay plans. Braj's sticker might serve as an anchor in a crisis, but he might just as well use it to cut himself free if one of us fell in. What should I do in that event? But it was no use. Braj had made himself the leader, and had made reasonable decisions to this point. There was no limit to the amount of time and energy I could put into spinning such alarming fantasies in my head. Better to attend to the here and now. Or was that the all's well talking? For the first few hours, we followed the tamped-down tracks left by the tractor. Then they veered downhill, following a cirque, a crescent-shaped vale cut by a tributary glacier, down toward the valley floor. This would take us straight to the military convoy, and so here we broke away from the trail and ventured across trackless snow for the first time. The first bit was slow going as we had to work our way up out of the cirque. By the time the slope began to level, I was ready to pull the ripcord in Braj's phrase. If I threw myself on the mercy of some military drummond operator, what was the worst that could happen? I hadn't broken any laws. It was only my three companions who had to go to such ridiculous lengths to avoid the authorities' notice. But for better or worse, I was roped up to them, and couldn't cut myself free without endangering their lives and mine. I had to wait for them to pull the ripcord. Then we crested a subsidiary ridge and came in view of the coastline. I was startled at how close it was. We had to shed some altitude, but the horizontal distance didn't look that great. We could easily pick out individual buildings in the port and count the military transport ships moored at its piers. Military aircraft were lined up at the edge of a dirty landing strip wedged in between the coast and the foot of the mountains. We watched one take off and bank to the south. One or two civilian ships were also in the harbor, and this gave us all the idea that if we could only get down there in one piece, which looked like less than a day's travel, we could buy passage on one of them and get out of here behind the next icebreaker. So we took a rest up there in preparation for what we all knew would be a long and arduous final push. I forced myself to eat two more energy bars. The things were starting to make me sick, but perhaps that was just me worrying about the all's well. I washed them down with water and refilled my snow pouches and my fuel bladder. Our supplies were holding up well. The sledge drivers had given us plenty, perhaps thinking that they might not be returning for a while. I was glad we had taken action, moved out, instead of huddling in that tent, not knowing if we'd live or die. After an hour's rest, we repacked the toboggan and got underway again. We descended into a round-bottomed cleft, another cirque that cut across our path and seemed to curve toward the port. Braj decided to follow this one down. The risk was that it would become too steep for us to negotiate and that we'd have to backtrack. On a few occasions during the next couple of hours, I became very worried about this, but then we would come around a bend or crest a little rise and get a view of the next mile or so and see that there was nothing we couldn't handle. On steeper bits, the toboggan would try to run ahead of me, and then I would have my hands full for a while. The only remedy was to slew it round ahead of me and let it pull me downhill as I leaned back against its weight. At such times, the others, who didn't have to contend with such a burden, would outdistance me. The rope joining me to Lara would draw taut and remind me of his impatience. I felt like reeling him in and smacking him. But Braj kept our pace from running out of control. Even in stretches that looked smooth and safe, he plodded along at the same rate, pausing every couple of steps to probe the snow ahead of him with his tent pole. I had long since learned to distinguish Braj's snowshoe prints from those of the others, and from time to time I would notice, to my indescribable annoyance, that they had diverged. Braj had zigged for whatever reason, and Dag had zagged, and Laro followed in his kinsman's steps, obligating me to do the same, and hence pass over ground that Braj had not probed. We had probably shed 3/4 of the altitude needed to reach the port. It would be relatively easy going from here. Laro and Dag were laborers. They had plenty of energy left and yearned to push on past the plodding Braj to a place where they could get a hot meal and peel off the accursed suit sacks. It was on one of those steep bits where the toboggan had swung around in front of me and I was straining back against 2 ropes at once that I noticed myself being pulled out of balance. The tension on the rope that connected me to Laro was rapidly increasing. I planted my left snowshoe and pulled back, but the last hour's descent had turned my leg muscles into quivering flab. I collapsed to my knee. The rope at my waist was pulling me forward. Just before I planted my face in the snow, I collected a glimpse of Braj standing up facing me, 100 feet away, sticker in hand. Laro was sliding and tumbling down the slope, pulling me with him. Dag, who was roped between Braj and Laro, was nowhere to be seen. That remembered image was all I had to go on during the next little while, because I was face down, being pulled along by Laro and by the toboggan. And, I realized, by Dag. He must have fallen into a crevasse. Why hadn't Braj stopped his fall? The rope, the frayed yellow 30-foot poly rope that had connected Braj to Dag, must have snapped. Either that or Braj had cut it with a swipe of his sticker. I was the only person who could stop this, and save Laro, Dag, and myself. I had to plunge that L-shaped piece of metal into the ice. I should have had it out and ready to use, should have been watching ahead for signs of trouble, but in order to free both hands to wrangle the toboggan, I'd stuck it in one of the equipment loops on the outside of my suit sack. Was it still there? I kicked wildly with one leg and managed to roll over on my back. My head was plowing up a bow wave of snow that buried my face. I snorted it out of my nose and stifled the urge to inhale. I groped around until I felt something hard and pulled it out, or so I guessed. Through those mittens it was hard to tell what was going on. I got the pick pointed away from my body, flailed the legs again, and managed to roll over on my stomach. My head came up out of the snow and I heard Laro screaming something. He must have gone over the brink of the crevasse. I put all of my weight on top of that L-shaped hunk of metal and drove it down. It caught, sort of, and became a pivot. My body spun around it as the rope at my waist, now drawn by the combined weights of Laro and Dag, torqued me downhill. The pick tugged at my hands, but not all that hard. It didn't seem to be holding. Or rather, it held, but it held in a raft of snow that had broken loose and was now sliding down the hill beneath me. This was just plain bad luck. If we had been traversing packed snow, the pick would have had something firm in which to get purchase. But yesterday's storm had left the packed ice covered with powdery stuff that slid freely on top of it. Another vicious jerk at my waist told me that the toboggan had just hurtled over the edge. I raised my face up out of this mini avalanche and got the weird idea that I wasn't actually moving, because, of course, the snow around me was moving at the same speed as I. Then there was nothing under my toes, nothing under my ankles, nothing under my knees, my hips. The rope jerked me straight down with the weight of three men. I guess I did a sort of backflip into the crevasse. But I only got to experience the terror of freefall for a fraction of a second before something terrible happened to my back and I stopped. The rope's force was pulling me down against something immobile and hard. Loose snow continued to pummel me for a while. I remembered a woolly story that Yul had told me about getting caught in an avalanche, the importance of swimming, of preserving airspace in front of one's face. I couldn't swim, but I did get one arm up and crooked an elbow over my mouth and nose. The weight of snow on my body built steadily. The tension on the rope slackened. Most of the avalanche seemed to be parting around me, falling away to either side as I remained stuck. For some reason, I heard Jessery's voice in my head saying, "Oh, so you're only being buried alive a little bit." What a jerk. Then it stopped. I could hear my own heart beating and nothing else. I pushed outwards with my elbow. The snow moved a little and gave me a void in front of my face, air for a moment. More importantly, it kept me from panicking and let me open my eyes. There was dim blue-gray light. I could hear Arcibald saying,
"Just enough to read by,"
and Leo answering,
"If only you'd thought to bring a book."
For whatever reason, I was not falling into the crevasse. Yet. And I didn't think I'd fallen too far into it. Something had stopped my fall. I guessed that the toboggan had gotten lodged sideways between the crevasse walls and I'd fallen on it. Hard. I took a moment to wiggle my toes and my ankles, just to verify that I hadn't broken my spine. It would have been nice to explore with my hands, but one was pinned at my side and the other, the one I'd crooked over my face, was hemmed in by snow. I was, however, able to move that one downwards over my body. I found the zipper pull from my front pocket and inched it open. Then I moved that hand up to my face and pulled my mitten off with my teeth. I reached my bare hand down into the open pocket and fished out my sphere. Spheres don't have controls as such. They recognize gestures. You talk to them with your hands. My hand was a little stiff, but I was able to make the unscrewing gesture that caused the sphere to get bigger. After a while, this became a little scary because the sphere was stealing my air supply, claiming the void in front of my face and pressing on my chest. But I had the idea that the snow over me wasn't that deep, so I kept telling it to expand. And just when I thought my own sphere was going to squeeze the life out of me, I heard rushing noises, a small avalanche. I reversed the gesture. The sphere got small, the weight came off, and I found myself gazing up through clear air between walls of blue ice. The sky was visible. And so was Braj, standing at the edge of the crevasse, looking down at me. I'd fallen about 20 feet.
"You're avout,"
was the first thing he said to me.
"Yes."
"Got anything else in your bag of tricks? Because I have no rope. It all went down with those two geeths."
He patted the length of yellow rope tied around his waist. Only a foot or so dangled below the knot. It had been severed at exactly the point where the blade of his sticker would have intercepted it in a moment of panic. Or of calculation.
"I thought maybe you cut it," I said.
I don't know why. I guess it was that weird avowed compulsion to state facts.
"Maybe I did."
We looked at each other for a while. It occurred to me that Braj was an exceptionally rational man, more so than some avowed. He was another like the Crades or Cord or Artisan Quinn who was smart enough to be an avowed, but who, for whatever reason, had ended up extramuros. In his case, it seemed that being alone out here with no bond to anyone else like him had made him utterly calculating and ruthless.
"Let's say you don't care whether I live or die," I said. "Let's say that every decision you've made has been based on self-interest. You kept us alive, brought us with you, and roped yourself to us because you knew that if you fell in, we'd try to help you. But the minute one of us fell in, you cut the rope to save yourself.
You look down into this crack out of simple curiosity. Nothing more. Then you saw my sphere. You know I'm a vout. What's your decision?
Brosh had found all of this faintly amusing. He rarely heard intelligent people state things clearly, and he sort of enjoyed its novelty. He pondered my question for a minute or so, turning away at one point to look down the slope. Then he turned back to scrutinize me.
"Move your legs,"
he said. I did.
"Arms."
I did.
"Those geeths were more trouble than they were worth,"
he said.
"Is that an ethnic slur for what Laro and Dag are?"
"Ethnic slur? Yes, an ethnic slur,"
he said in a mocking tone.
"Geeths are great for digging ditches and pulling weeds, worse than useless up here. But you might keep me alive. How are you going to get out of there?"
For 3,700 years, we had lived under a ban that prevented us from owning anything other than the bolt, the cord, and the sphere. Shelves of books had been written about the ingenious uses to which these objects had been put by a vout who had found themselves in trying circumstances. Many of the tricks had names. Sant Ablavan's ratchet, Ramgad's contraption, the lazy fra. I was no expert, but when we'd been younger, Jessery and I had leafed through some such books and practiced a few of those tricks, just for sport. Cords and bolts were made of the same stuff, a fiber that could coil into a tight helix, becoming short and bulky and springy, or relax into a straight filament, becoming long, lean, and inelastic. In the winter, we told the fibers in our bolts to coil up. They got much shorter, but the bolt became thick and warm because of the pockets of air involved with those coils. In summer, we straightened them, and the bolts became long and sheer. Likewise, the cord could be fat and yarn-like, or long and thready. I made my sphere about as big as my head, wrapped my bolt around it, and tied it together with my cord. Then I made the sphere get bigger and let the bolt expand with it. The sphere wedged itself between the walls. It could go up, but it wouldn't go down, because the crevasse was wider at the top and narrower below. I pushed it up a short distance, and it found a new equilibrium, a little higher. Then I expanded and pushed, a few inches at a time. The walls were surprisingly irregular, so all of this was more complicated than I'm making it sound, but once I got the hang of it, it went fast.
"Got it,"
Braj called. The sphere moved away from me, scraping against the ice walls. A panic came over me until I found my cord with a flailing arm. Then I let it slide through my hand until Braj had pulled the sphere all the way out of the crevasse. Braj and I were now linked by the cord. He jammed his sticker into the ice up there and wrapped my cord around its handle, or so he claimed. I didn't want to lose our connection to the toboggan and to Laro and Dag, but I had to cut myself free of it to have any hope of bettering things. The end of my cord I joined to the loop of rope around my waist. Then I cut my way free from that loop. So I was free of the hundreds of pounds of stuff anchoring me to the bottom. The cord was now our only link to the toboggan and to Laro and Dag. I gave instructions to Braj on how to make the sphere smaller. He threw it down to me. I wedged it between the crevasse walls again. This time, now that I had freedom to move, I was able to get astride it. For the first time since the accident, I took my weight off of whatever hard thing had stopped my fall and saved my life. Looking down at it, I verified that it was indeed the toboggan, wedged at an angle between the crevasse walls like a stick thrust between a monster's jaws. When I took my weight off of it, it shifted, and a moment later it fell, tumbling another 10 feet before getting wedged again. Braj had anchored his loop of the cord to his sticker, jammed in the ice, so we didn't lose it. I was able to extricate myself from the crevasse by expanding the sphere, which pushed me up as it inflated, while keeping the cord looped around one hand in case I fell off. Once I was out, we doubled the anchor by driving in my makeshift ice axe and secured the cord to that as well. For a little while, we were able to haul the rope up by causing the cord to get shorter, a simple implementation of Sant Ablavan's ratchet. But after a few minutes, it ran out of stored energy. If I left it out in the sun for a while, it would recharge, but we didn't have time, and it wasn't able to store a lot of energy anyway. So after that, Braj and I hauled using muscle power. Once we had gotten the toboggan up on the surface, this became markedly easier. A few moments later, Laro's corpse could be seen deep down in the valley of blue light, emerging from the snow that had piled up in the bottom. The rope that trailed below him was no more than 10 feet long and ended in a botched knot. It had held well enough to drag down Laro, me, and the toboggan, but must have given way under the jerk when the toboggan and I came to rest. After that, Dag must have free-fallen to the very bottom of the crevasse and been buried under falling snow. I hoped his death had been quicker than the long, agonizing slide and tumble that had preceded it. Braj kept throwing me dirty looks as if to say, "Why are we doing this?" But I ignored him and kept pulling on the rope until we had brought Laro's body up to the brink of the crevasse. As we were rolling him up onto the surface at last, he twitched, gasped, and called out the name of his deity. Now I understood Braj. He was smarter, more rational than I at the moment. He had probably been wondering, what'll we do if he turns out to be alive? I just lay there on the snow for a few minutes, half dead. All the injuries I had suffered in the fall were now making themselves obvious. There was nothing to do but go on. Braj was furious to have been burdened with an injured man and kept stamping around in circles and gazing hungrily down the slope, wondering whether he should chance it alone. After a few minutes, he decided to stay with us. For now. Laro had a broken thigh, and his skull had taken a beating during the fall, creating some bloody lacerations. Between that and being buried in snow for a while, he was groggy. One of Laro's snowshoes still dangled from his foot. I took it apart and used its pieces to splint his leg. Then I made my sphere big and flat on the snow. The sphere is a porous membrane. Each pore is a little pump that can move air in or out. It's like a self-inflating balloon. The spring constant, the stretchiness of the membrane, is controllable. If you turn the stretchiness way down, that is, make it stiff, and pump in lots of air, it becomes a hard little pill. What I did now was the opposite. I made it very stretchy and removed most of the air. I spread my bolt flat on the snow and dragged the flaccid sphere onto it. Then I got Braj to help me roll Laro into the middle. He screamed and cried out to his mother and his deity as we were doing this. I took that as a good sign because he was seeming more alert. I rolled him in the sphere and then wrapped the bolt loosely around that, leaving his head exposed. The whole bundle I tied with my cord. Finally, I inflated the sphere a little bit while telling the bolt not to stretch. The sphere expanded to form an airbed that cocooned Laro's whole body. The bundle was between 2 and 3 feet in diameter and slid over the snow reasonably well, since I'd made the bolt sheer and smooth. I could never have pulled it up a slope, but going downhill ought to work. I towed Laro, and Braj towed the toboggan. We tied ourselves together with a length of good rope that had formerly connected me to Laro, and set out in the same style as before, with Braj going first and using his tent pole to probe for crevasses. I tried not to think about the possibility that Dag might still be alive in the bottom of the crevasse. Then I tried not to wonder how many other migrants' corpses would be found strewn all over this territory if all the ice and snow ever melted. Then I tried not to wonder if Orlo's might be among them. For now, I'd just have to settle for making sure I wasn't among them. I paid close attention to Braj's footprints. If Braj went into another crevasse, I might try to save him, which was why he had kept me alive. But if I went in, Laro and I were both dead. So I stepped where he stepped. After a few hours, I lost awareness of what was happening. Everything I had was channeled into keeping my feet moving. There's not much point in trying to offer a description of the bleakness, the moral and physical misery. In those rare moments when I was lucid enough to think, I reminded myself that Avout had been through far worse ordeals in the third sack and at other such times. Since I was so groggy, I have no way of guessing when Braj parted company with us. Laro's voice brought me to awareness. He was screaming and fighting with the sphere, trying to get out. I told Braj we had to stop. Hearing no answer, I looked around and discovered that he was gone. The rope that had connected us had fallen victim to a sticker. And no wonder. We were on the floor of a valley that led straight to the port, a couple of miles away, and the ground was black and burnished smooth by all the tires and treads that had passed over it. We were on the path of the military convoy. No worries about crevasses here. So Braj had taken off. I never saw him again. Laro was frantic to get out. Perhaps he'd been that way for a long time. I was worried he'd hurt himself flailing around. I inflated the sphere until he couldn't move at all, and then I knelt beside him and looked into his eyes and tried to talk some sense into him. This was monumentally difficult. I had known some, such as Tulia, who could do it effortlessly. Or at least she made it look that way. Yul simply would have bellowed into his face, used the force of his personality. But it was not a thing that came easily to me. He wanted to know where Dag was. I told him Dag was dead, which did nothing to calm him down, but couldn't lie to him, and I was too exhausted to devise a better plan. The sound of engines cut through the still, frigid air. It came from up valley. A small convoy of military fetches was headed our way, detached from the huge procession, to go back and run some errand at the port. By the time they approached within hailing distance, Laro had got a grip on himself, if hopeless, uncontrollable sobbing could be so described. I relaxed the sphere, undid the cord, and dragged him free of the bundle, then got everything stowed back in my pockets. Those guys in the military trucks were real pros. They came right over and picked us up. They took us into town. They didn't ask questions, at least none that I remember. Though I was not exactly in a mirthful frame of mind, I marked this down as being funny. With my simple-minded view of the secular world, I'd assumed that the soldiers, simply because they looked sort of like cops with their uniforms and weapons, would act like cops and arrest us. But it turned out that they couldn't have cared less about law enforcement, which made perfect sense once I thought about it for 10 seconds. They took Laro to a charity clinic run by the local Kelks, a religion that was strong in these parts. Then they dropped me off at the edge of the water. I bought some decent food at a tavern and slept face down on the table until I was ejected. Standing out there on the street, I felt stretched thin, diluted, as if that pale Arctic sunlight could shine right through me and give my heart a sunburn. But I could still walk, and I had money. The sledge driver had never collected the second half of his fare. I bought passage on the next outbound transport, boarded it as soon as they'd let me, climbed into a bunk, and slept one more time in that horrible suit sack.
Kelks. 1. A religious faith created during the 16th or 17th century AR. The name is a contraction of the Orth Ganakalux, meaning triangle place, so called because of the symbolic importance of triangles in the faith's iconography. 2. An Ark of the Kelks Faith. Kedev, a devotee of the Kelks or Triangle Faith. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
About halfway into the 4-day cruise, I had recovered to the point where I was capable of introspection. I spent a lot of time sitting very still in the ship's mess, eating. I had to sit still because I had messed up my ribs and back in the fall, and it hurt to move, even to breathe. The food was good compared to energy bars. Perhaps I ate so much of it in hopes that it would bring up the level of Allswell in my blood and chase the dark thoughts from my head. Getting me killed couldn't have been part of Fra Jad's plan. When then had it gone wrong? My foolish choices? The migrant traffic over the pole had been going on at least long enough for Jad to have heard about it. He'd known that a pharaoh like Orlo would take that route to Ekba. So it was an ancient and settled practice. We'd all underestimated its dangers precisely because it was so ancient. We'd assumed that nothing could go on for so long unless it was safe. The way Avout would run things if we were in charge. But we weren't in charge, and it wasn't run that way. Or maybe it was a safe and settled thing most of the time, but the military convoy had thrown it into chaos. Or maybe we had just been unlucky.
You look like you've been through a harrowing experience.
I snapped out of it and looked up by rotating my eyeballs, not my head, as I had a terrible crick in the neck. A man was standing there looking at me, probably in his third decade. I had noticed him eyeing me the day before. Now he had come over and said this to me as a way of striking up a conversation. I'm sorry to say I broke out laughing. It took me a minute to get it under control. Harrowing was a thing that we did, literally, to our tangles during the spring. We went through the beds on hands and knees, identifying the weeds and rooting them out with hand hose, throwing the weeds on a pile to be burned, leaving nothing except churned up soil, pulverizing the clods in our hands to leave a loose bed for expansion of the tangle plant's root systems. So when this stranger suggested I'd been through a harrowing experience, my mind went straight to that, and I thought he was trying to say that I looked as if I'd been crawling through dirt, which I did. Or perhaps that I looked like a heap of dead weeds, which I also did. Finally, I remembered that I was extramuros, where the old literal meaning of harrowing had been forgotten thousands of years ago, and it had become a cliché, uprooted from any concrete meaning. None of this could be explained to the stranger, so all I could do was sit there and helplessly giggle, which made my ribs hurt, and hope he wouldn't take umbrage and slug me. But he was patient. He even looked a little pained to behold someone in such a pathetic state, which was fortunate, since he was a big man and could have slugged me hard. This gave me an idea that stopped the giggle. "Hey," I said, "do you have any spare clothes? I'd buy them from you."
"You do need clean clothes," the stranger said.
This brought me back to giggling. From time to time I'd get a whiff of myself. I knew it was bad, but I couldn't very well don my bolt.
"I have more clothes than I need and will gladly part with them," he said.
He had an odd way of talking. Quasi-literate seculars went to stores and bought prefabricated letters, machine-printed on heavy stock with nice pictures, and sent them to each other as emotional gestures. They were written in a stilted language that no one ever spoke aloud, except for this guy who was standing in front of me, letting fly with words like harrowing. He went on,
"I don't ask for anything in return, but I do hope you'll join me for services after you've changed."
So that was it. This guy wanted to convert me to his ark. He had been watching me and had picked me out as a wretch, a soul ripe for saving. I had nothing better to do, and it had become all too obvious that I needed to grow a little wiser in the ways of the secular world. So I threw away my stinking clothes and my suit sack, bathed as best as I could while standing in front of a sink, and put on this guy's funny-smelling clothes. Then I went to a hot, crowded cabin where his ark was holding its services. There were a dozen and a half devotees and one magister, a leathery man named Sark, who apparently spent his life banging around on ships like this, ministering to sailors and fishermen. This was a kelx, a triangle ark. Its adherents were called Kedevs. It was a completely different faith from that of Ganeliel Craed. It had been invented about 2,000 years ago by some ingenious prophet who must have been unusually self-effacing since little was known about him and he wasn't worshipped as such. Like most faiths, it was as fissured and fractured as the glaciers I'd been walking over lately. But all of its sects and schisms agreed that there was another world outside of and greater, in a sense more real, than the one we lived in. That in this world there was a robber who had waylaid a family. He had slain the father outright, raped and killed the mother, and taken their daughter with him as a hostage. Not long after, while trying to evade capture, he had strangled the innocent girl. But he had been caught anyway and locked up in a dungeon for a long time, half of his life, while waiting for his case to come before a magistrate. At the trial, he admitted his guilt. The magistrate had asked if there was any reason why he should not be put to death. the condemned man had responded that there was such a reason, one that had come to him during his years in the dungeon. As he had meditated over his hideous crimes, the one thing he had never been able to chase from his mind was the murder of the girl, the innocent, because in her there had been the potential to do so many things that could now never be realized. In any soul, the condemned man argued, was the ability to create a whole world as big and variegated as the one that he and the magistrate lived in. But if this was true of the innocent, it was true of the condemned man as well, and so he should not, no one should ever, be put to death. The magistrate, upon hearing this, had voiced skepticism that the condemned man really had it in him to generate a whole world. Taking up the challenge, the condemned man had begun to tell the tale of a world he had thought up in his mind, and to relate the stories of its gods, heroes, and kings. This had taken up the whole day, so the magistrate had adjourned the court. But he had warned the condemned man that his fate was still in the balance because the world he had invented seemed to be just as full of wars, crimes, and cruelty as the one that they lived in. The condemned man's stay of execution was only as good as the world he had invented. If the various troubles in that world could not be brought to a satisfactory conclusion in tomorrow's session, he would be executed at sundown. The next day, the condemned man had attempted to satisfy the magistrate, and made a little headway, but in so doing introduced new troubles and gave birth to new characters no less morally ambiguous than the first lot. The magistrate could not find sufficient grounds to execute him, and so had continued the case to the next day, and the next, and the next. The world that I lived in with Jessery and Leo and Arcibalt, Orlo and Jad, Ayla and Tulia and Cord and all the others was the very world that was being created from day to day in the mind of the condemned man in that courtroom. Sooner or later it would all end in a final judgment by the magistrate. If our world seemed, on balance, like a decent place to him, he would let the condemned man live, and our world would go on existing in his mind. If the world as a whole only reflected the condemned man's depravity, the magistrate would have him executed, and our world would cease to exist. We could help keep the condemned man alive and thus preserve the existence of ourselves and our world by striving at all times to make it a better place. That's why Alwash,